Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hi, my name is Danny Roth, and this is Everyday Horror. It's a podcast where we watch at least one horror movie for every day in the month of October, and then we get spooky as hell and talk about it. That's how you do it. Today I'm joined by the managing editor at Decider, Alex Albin. Hey, man. How you doing?
Hey, how are you? I'm excited to chat about all this stuff. I'm excited to get spooky.
Yeah, that was scary immediately. Already a spill. just right down the spine, a chill. I actually said a spill because I got so excited that I combined spine and chill.
Yeah. Ooh, you gotta copyright that. You could probably sell it to Shudder or something like that.
There you go. I mean, I do like money and Shudder's got it, I guess. So you, as happens and is going to be, I think, relevant to our conversation, just you put your kids to bed before you talked about horror stuff with me. Like, just put them out and we're like, let's talk about scary shit.
Yeah, we're going to talk about It, Stephen King's It, which is 50% at least about kids, and certainly something that completely was very seminal for me as maybe not a child, but I can barely remember anything in my life from when I'm a kid. I really don't remember years very well, but I very specifically remember I read the novel It when I was 13. And I remember that because it was all about these kids moving from being young kids to adulthood. And I read this book at the exact same time as I was going through the same thing. And I was completely obsessed with Stephen King novels at that point. But it made a huge, huge impression on me.
So was that your first Stephen King book?
No, it wasn't. My first Stephen King book was actually Tommyknockers. I was on I was on a family vacation. I don't remember where, but I can picture the room still that we were staying in, me and my brother. It was some, like, maybe we were in Vermont or something like that. And we were staying in a cabin type place. We both had small twin beds, and in front of my twin bed was a dresser, and on top of the dresser was a bunch of very dog-eared novels. And I was completely bored out of my mind, so I started, you know, looking through the novels, and this book Tommyknockers struck me, and I was like, oh, let me check that out. I've never read this Stephen King guy. Let me see what's up with that. And I did not leave the room the entire time reading Tommyknockers. Obviously a very weird Stephen King book to start with, but I became completely obsessed after that, went back to the library when we got home, read every Stephen King book I can get my hands on. When I was taking a look back before recording the podcast, I was trying to figure out the timing on it. I came to the stuff a little late. I think I probably read it about the same time or right before the movie miniseries, the TV miniseries, was coming out. So I read it years later, but that was one that just hit me right in the right spot.
It now makes me think, because related to Tommyknockers and miniseries, there was also one of those, as I seem to recall. I'm pretty sure they made one.
They did. That's one of the few that I haven't seen. I've seen, at least in my prime Stephen King time, I think I've gotten out of it a little bit, frankly, as I've had kids and gotten busy doing other things with jobs. I haven't really kept up with as many of his novels as I'd like, but there was a point that I would go to see every Stephen King movie. I'd watch every TV miniseries. I'd read every novel and every short story, read all of the forewords and afterwards that he'd write and everything. I was completely obsessed with it. But for some reason, Tommyknockers is the one that passed me by. And I think it was because, to be honest, I was so freaked out about it. There was that whole thing about people's teeth falling out, and that creeped me out so bad.
Oh, that is exactly why. Yeah, that is one of my number one creep outs, as anyone who has been listening to now 27 days of this podcast in a row. Yes, teeth are a thing that I'm absolutely terrified by. And yeah, for sure. And It's in there. It's funny because much like 1990s It, the 1993 two-episode miniseries event that they did for the Tommyknockers was not particularly well received, but I remember watching it and that was a thing that I taped off of TV and that as it aired and then rewatched it a bunch of times because, you know, it had a kind of like an alien thing going on and teeth stuff and just, it was really creepy. I remember really, really liking it. And now knowing that, that we've had an It movie come out in 2017 to enormous success, and the trailer at this point for Pet Sematary with, you know, John Lithgow doing a lot of the narration, which also, looks like it's probably going to do all right. It makes me wonder if maybe they'll come around and maybe, like, even though Tommyknockers is weird and not a typical Stephen King. I mean, I don't know, guys, if you want to make some money, maybe make a Tommyknockers movie. Literally, why not?
It's an interesting thing because I feel like there was a good span of time where as much as I love Stephen King, if a Stephen King adaptation was coming out in movies or on TV, it was probably going to be bad.
Yeah.
Like really poorly made, maybe some good things about it, but just not good at all. And there's some sort of sweet spot that's been hit now, both with It and another one that kind of got past me, but Gerald's Game. I heard that's fantastic as well.
I enjoyed that. Yeah. It's worth a look if you have the time.
So that's great. I mean, I think I hope that keeps going, and I hope we get a really good Tommyknockers adaptation. Though,
yeah, there you go.
Given the power of podcast. I'll check it out.
Yeah, power of podcast. It'll make it happen. But
we'll make it happen.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting? I have to say, I watched that miniseries, the It miniseries. I mean, so the miniseries came out in 1990, which means I would have been 10 years old. And I have to tell you, there's a thing about, you know, the whole good bad spectrum. It's definitely different when you're a kid. That miniseries scared the shit out of me. Like, yeah, it was amazing. I loved it as a kid.
I mean, I'm a little older than you. I was 13 when that came out, but same thing. I remember watching it. I remember being totally freaked out by Tim Curry as Pennywise. It's funny, I can't really remember any of the final confrontations or the scares or anything like that, but I do very clearly remember the adults sitting and talking in the backyard and trying to figure things out and just being very impressed by it dramatically as a kid or a teenager, I guess. Yeah, it's one of those things that going back and watching scenes, it doesn't exactly hold up, but Tim Curry is still so good as Pennywise. I think that powers it through almost more than anything.
That was one of those books that I feel like was in every home. Like everybody, because the book, in case people don't know, is big. It's a big, thick ass book.
Yeah, I think it's 1,300 pages, something like that.
Yeah, it's an enormous, enormous book at a time when I don't really know how common books of that length were in popular fiction. I definitely bought it as a kid. I did not get through it because I was not a voracious reader then, and I'm borderline illiterate now. But but man, like, yes, I think everybody that I knew owned a copy, and everybody that I knew had seen that miniseries. It was in that very early 90s period was genuinely, I think, like a phenomenon. Like, I don't think I'm inventing that. I think it was just one of those cultural milestones. And when you try to understand where this cultural fear of clowns comes from, I feel like this is in the top five, at least.
I think that's fair. I think that's something that definitely... I don't know necessarily pre-It, but I would say post-It, there's no way you can think of Fear of Clowns without thinking about It and without thinking about Pennywise. That's just part and parcel with what it is. And to your point about the phenomenon, I would argue there's a couple of things that were going on there. I completely agree with you about that, by the way, that Stephen King had already made his name with all of these different books that did so well, very specifically horror books. Salem's Lot, there was Firestarter, Cujo before that, Christine, Not to be glib about it, but like his cocaine period when he was writing these amazing books while he was high on cocaine, he just jammed through all of these and people love them. But it is, even though it's technically a horror book, it's cross genre. There's a lot of other things that are happening with it. There's a very deep fantasy element, almost a science fiction element, but not quite. There's big mythology there. But more than anything, it really, it's not fast and dirty like a Cujo or Christine. It's really makes you live with the characters, like literally live with them as it's going through the two different time periods. And again, to your point about it being a phenomenon, I think that's what people responded to, that even people who would say, oh, I'm not really a horror fan, you could read it because it was literature. You know, it was a book that you could actually read and delve and talk about and understand and had some depth to it. And talking a little beyond it, that was a change point for him because if I remember correctly, right after or right around the same time as It Was Misery, which again, that's more straight up horror, but it's a very different sort of horror and a more realistic sort of horror than the stuff that he'd written before that was more supernatural based. And people got into that in a different way. So that's really like, I think that's prime Stephen King right there. It hit it exactly the right point and in exactly the right way.
You look at it and it's one part Sandlot. Like there's this whole element of, yeah, like everybody has a, you know, if not a small town, then, and you know, because it's like, so like I was saying, with no distractions at all, so I grew up in the 1980s, and sort of this town that I was in sent me to a preschool, and to sort of, the thing that I always sort of think of as relates to it is the indoctrination of what you think is safe but isn't really. So mm-hmm. I went, so my preschool was called the Jelly Bean School. And the reason it was called the Jelly Bean School is because Ronald Reagan loves jelly beans. And I always thought that was such a perfect thing. I always thought that Stephen King had, in a way, really captured that kind of mentality, right? Because here I was in preschool thinking, our president loves jelly beans. Meanwhile, he's like, who's that AIDS killing? Sounds good. Like, these things are concurrent. This, you know, both those things were true. And so it was a matter of what you were being told as a kid, plus the actual danger to you, just because you were a kid and didn't know that it didn't mean that it wasn't there. And I feel like Stephen King kind of tapped into that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It's funny that you say that because you're 100% apt. Your reading of the novel is, I think, far better than mine was as a kid, because my base level was, oh, they're losers, I'm a loser. Cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it. You know, just as a kid who loved horror novels, as a kid who loved superheroes and comic books and everything, anything that had the idea of, oh, everybody hates us and beats us up, but we're the only people that can save the world, I was full on into. And it definitely hit all of those things because I was obsessed with Stephen King, as I said, and I loved all of his novels and I loved his writing. I loved the mythology building. I think by that time I had already read some of the Terry Pratchett Discworld stuff. So when the turtle showed up towards the end of it, I was like, oh man, yeah. It's all connected, dude. So again, into that on a very silly, non-analytical level. But just that idea of, I think if I was to think back and sort of plug a little deeper about it, what I think I really gelled into about it, particularly with the different timelines, was feeling like a loser at that point at age 13, but knowing you were going to get past that, you know, that you were going to get through that, that you would hold on to those things, because the novel was very much about how those things that happened to you as a kid come back as an adult. But what I think I saw was the idea that, oh, I'm 13, I might, you know, not to get too dark, but I'm going to survive past this. Like, this horrible feeling that I have right now is constant feeling of rage and sadness and confusion and all of these hormones that are rushing through me. I'm going to get past them and I'm going to survive and be an adult and maybe battle those monsters again. But ultimately, I will continue. And I do think that is something that maybe I didn't totally realize on a surface level, but certainly something that I felt very deeply when I was reading the book.
I think that's so smart. You know, I for me, it was Doctor Who that made me feel that way, because I especially when I was really, really, really young, I was one of those kids that got beat up after school every day from about first grade onward, for reasons which the short version is, and my parents didn't tell me this until very recently, it turned out, because my first teacher was very mean to me, and I thought it was because I was a shitty kid. Alex, would you like to know why it actually turned out that my first grade teacher was mean to me?
Sure.
It was because it turns out she was a huge anti-Semite. Anyway, so cool. That was cool. So anyway, so I got beat up a lot as a kid, and so I would stay home. I was like, I feel sick. So I was home a lot, and I used to watch Doctor Who during the early Tom Baker, Phil Hinchcliffe era stuff, and that was very horror-driven. But the thing about Tom Baker's Doctor is that he's like, I mean, a lot of the incarnations of that guy is that he's not a tough guy. He's sort of a dork. Mm-hmm. And yet he always manages to come out on top. Like, he uses his intelligence and his wits to get to the end. So I always sort of felt kind of seen by that particular character. I found him very relatable. But yeah, I think it's really smart to sort of view the Losers Club in that fashion, the analog to feeling like you could get through that, and thereby as an adult, you know, just because it's not going to be easy doesn't mean like you get through the stuff as a kid, you're able to get through the stuff as an adult. And it actually makes me so, like, how old are your kids, Alex? How old are they? Is that okay? Or are we allowed to talk about that on a podcast?
No, it's
or is
fine.
That...
I throw them under the bus all the time on multiple podcasts, so it's all good. My son is 4 and my daughter is 9. So my son is pretty like, everything's great in the world. I find everything hilarious and awesome right now. But my daughter, I don't know if she's going to wake up and hear this, but she's definitely hitting the part now where she's starting to realize very deeper, more complex feelings about things. And it's good to watch because it's wonderful to see her grow up. But it also makes my heart go out to her because I know I got through those feelings as well. And I know what it feels like, because the other thing that I think about a lot is, particularly when we're young, we have a deeper well of emotions, I think, because this is the first time we're feeling those things, versus as an adult, you still may feel the same heartache or feel the same joy about something, but you felt it 10, 20, 50 times before. So it's gotten whittled down a little bit through repetition. So I don't know. I think I got kind of far afield, but you know, in terms of it specifically, that's why you have that first confrontation is so big and it's so epic and it's so, yes, we are taking down Pennywise, let's do this. And then the second time, they lose so much. it costs them so much more because they don't believe in themselves as much, I think. You know, it's been a while, honestly, since I've revisited the novel. And obviously, I haven't seen the second movie since isn't coming out until next year. But I think that is one of the things there, that they have this epic, almost victory at the beginning. And then by the time they're adults, there's no way that they could completely win. They sort of do, but they sort of don't at the same time.
I'm really excited to see sort of this chapter 2 mm-hmm. adaptation, because it's a weird thing to think about, especially, you know, I mean, I don't have kids, but I'm surrounded by people that do now. And you think back to it and it's like, things are surmountable as a kid. And yes, as an adult, you know how to deal with certain things, but man, mortality is real. And you just become aware of a lot of things. It's like, I don't know, like when you're a kid, most of the time you get sick and then you get better. you know, I'm middle-aged. When I get sick, most of the time something stays broke. You know what I mean? Like, if I get really sick, something, like, you know, like every time I get a really, really bad, like, cold or flu or something, if it gets into my lungs, when that thing is all over, my lungs are permanently a little more worse for the wear, you know? And mm-hmm. like, that's one of those things that sort of separates adulthood from childhood, is that you're not made of rubber anymore. And it's interesting to watch a story play out wherein, you know, you have these kids fight a very specific kind of evil and then have to revisit that same thing as adults and just how different the consequences are.
I know I was telling you this earlier, but I wrote a piece for Decider totally coincidentally, actually, earlier today. I think it's going up next week sometime, depending on when this podcast goes up. Obviously, maybe it's already up. Who knows? But something that I found since I've had kids, and it really crystallized it for me watching the more recent movie, It, is having kids completely ruined horror movies for me. That there's this very clear line of, I loved horror movies. I'd go to see every single horror movie when it would come out. I was never really a person that was like, ooh, I'm going to find this weird cult movie that has terrible special effects and track it down. But it was a mainstream horror flick. I was definitely there opening night in the theater, screaming along with everybody. I loved having Nightmare on Elm Street marathons. And even though Aliens scared the crap out of me, I loved watching the, I was obsessed with the Aliens movies. When I had kids, it wasn't immediate. And in fact, it went very much even deeper in that direction. And this is something I've heard from other parents, but not that it's a horror movie, but I remember very specifically the first thing my wife and I did when we took my daughter home when she was born was we watched Game of Thrones. And we just sat there and like zogged out and binged Game of Thrones. And we were like, is this too violent? And we're like, it doesn't matter. And I've talked to other parents too, who do Law and Order SVU marathons, or they'll do some other hyper violent thing. And this is something that, again, they're like very crystallized for me while I was writing the piece earlier today. I didn't even really realize it until I thought about it. But I think it comes out of, you're in a room, if you are in the room for the birth, which I was, but you're watching a small thing that you love crawl out of another thing that you love, which is like this amazing, beautiful thing, but it's also literally the most horrifying thing I can think of in my life. And there's blood everywhere and gore everywhere. And the only way you can really deal with that, I think, is by watching stories about that. So you process it, and then that birth becomes just kind of another story. So for that, for the first couple of weeks when my daughter was, you know, just a gurgling, pooping, eating, crying, and that was pretty much just mess, we did that and that was fine. But as soon as she started to develop a personality, and as soon as you started to understand her, even as a tiny little person, but as her own person, I couldn't really watch horror movies in the same way anymore. I can't even really go to see them in the theater most of the time, because it's just too scary on two different levels. That, and I felt this while I was watching it. I actually never saw it in the theaters because I thought, I can't do this. I can't deal with this. I ended up watching it at home in about 10-minute chunks because I had to take a pause every once in a while. Because first of all, there's the children in danger aspect of it. And there's no way, once you have kids, you can't watch a movie and not think, what if that was my kids? Oh my God, what if my kids were biking off alone in a house and suddenly they encounter a killer cloud? You know, you can't not internalize that, because frankly, every time I walk out of the door in the morning to go to work and I'm like, well, goodbye, there's a thought that flits through my head of like, maybe this is the last time I see them. Okay, there we go. What horrible things are going to happen today? So you watch it from that perspective, but then there's from the adult perspective as well, where I sit in a movie and if it's something horrible happening to an adult, they're getting chopped to pieces, particularly if it's somebody who's a parent. I think, what if that was me? Not that it's necessarily going to be happening that like I'll be in space and eaten by an alien or something, but what if I left my kids alone in that scenario? What would happen to them? So every single thing that I view now, from dishwasher commercials that involve families all the way up to horror films, are through that lens of having kids, through that lens of having a family. But in a very real way, it's affected horror movies almost more, most of all, because they have that very real, very palpable danger. And something like It, which I'll say, I thought the 2017 movie was phenomenal and I loved it and I'm glad I saw it and powered through it, but it was very difficult to watch.
Wow. I mean, I think that makes so much sense. But counterpoint, and this is a thing that it just popped into my mind as you were talking about that. And I wonder, you said you've watched Game of Thrones and your kids have been in the room. Is that a thing that's happened?
Yeah, but when they were like little babies and aren't going to remember anything.
All right. Well, then, but what I find in my own personal life, and this is again one of those things that I encountered with people as I've gone through this 31 days of watching horror movies, which I think has probably ruined my psyche completely by now. But I watched Evil Dead 2 when I was a kid with my dad. That was a movie that he picked, and he was like, "This movie is great. Let's watch it." And we did. And I had, you know, he's like, there's not really like a lot of nudity. It's really gory, but it's mostly a roller coaster ride. And he showed it to me and we watched it together and it instantly became one of those go-to films. You know, it was like that and Groundhog Day. If those things were on, man, me and my dad were watching them. And I discovered a lot of people had kind of a similar experience. Mm-hmm. I'd had Valerie Complex on a couple days ago and her very first horror movie was Night of the Demons. And I was like, the movie where Linnea Quigley gets possessed and puts a lipstick in her boobie, that's the, you watch that with your parents? And she was like, yeah, I watched that with my dad. And I wonder if partially the key is not that you get to a point where, or I mean, I don't know if in 2018 that's still really a thing that parents would do, but I think my dad, and I think a lot of parents, once they're able to watch horror movies with their kids and the kids are able to process them as something that is scary but also fun, mm-hmm. I wonder if that changes the psychology of how you view horror movies again.
I probably does. And actually, to tie together a couple of things we've been talking about, the first TV show that we're really watching together as a family, all four of us, is the new Doctor Who with Jodie Whittaker. My daughter was great. So excited when she heard that she had gotten the part. She, just to give like a little bit of backstory, this has nothing to do with horror, but I continue to find this hilarious. When Peter Capaldi got cast as Doctor Who, I had to watch the casting special that the BBC did for work. So I was sitting at home and I was like, we'll just put this on and watch this. My daughter, who I guess must have been 2 or 3 at the time, something like that, was super into it and talking about how much she loved it. And for years afterwards, even though that was the only Doctor Who thing she had ever seen, would talk about, oh, I'm a huge Doctor Who fan. I love Peter Capaldi. He's my favorite doctor. But we never showed her the actual show or anything like that. She just loved the casting special. But when she heard of Jodie Whittaker, we thought, oh, maybe we can actually try to watch it. And so we've watched by now, I guess, the first 3 episodes have aired. So we've watched those together as a family. And the first episode, for those listening who haven't seen it, the first episode, there's a legitimately scary villain where he takes off a mask. They ask him, he's been stealing teeth. And they say, why do you want the teeth? And he takes off his mask and his face has all of the teeth embedded in it. And that's pretty upsetting. Yeah. Even as an adult, I was like, that's... That's upsetting. But we watched it and my daughter was terrified the entire time, like crying, terrifying, watching it. And we kept saying, if you want to stop watching it, it's okay. And she kept crying and saying, no, it's okay. I want to watch it. I'm very excited. But my son, on the other hand, when Toothface came on, ran into the other room and I could see him, you know, sort of peeking his head out a little bit behind the door. And then somehow halfway through the episode, something snapped in his brain and he's like, oh, this isn't scary. And then proceeded to sit down on the couch and every couple of minutes would turn to us and say, this isn't scary at all. While my daughter, mind you, was still sobbing her brains out, terrified about the whole episode. But we've watched each of those 3 episodes. The second one had maybe some kind of scary elements in it. The third one they were very excited about because was about Rosa Parks and they knew the Rosa Parks story and they were so excited to see her live action. But that's something where I've been thinking about what you've been talking about. The reason I bring it up is that it's not so much wearing my daughter down through scaring her because I want to respect her feelings. And if she is legitimately scared, she can leave. She can go do whatever. We'll figure something else out. But in the back of my brain, I think the more of this she sees, the easier this is going to become to watch and the better overall it'll be for her because she will be able to embrace and check out all of these different things. And to bring it back around to your point, maybe that does mean she's still kind of a scaredy cat with no insults meant whatsoever, but she really is. But maybe sometime in a year or two. Sure, you know, we could try. I can't even think of what a like slightly scary horror movie is. I don't think she could ever watch It or anything like that. But maybe we could slowly work on it past Doctor Who to other things. And I think that would be great. I'd like to get back to watching them. I like horror movies. They're good.
Yeah, man, it's interesting, the psychology of kids and the turning point of when a thing is scary and when a thing is not scary anymore. But also, yeah, you saying that your daughter is freaking out but wants to keep watching the thing. I mean, that was, again, Doctor Who, the very first episode I ever saw, I remember distinctly. It was the Android Invasion. It was a Tom Baker, Sarah Jane Smith joint, or Liz Sladen joint, and there's a thing where, you know, as the title might suggest, there were androids, and the androids are sort of, you know, trying to replace real people. And there's an android version of Sarah Jane. As a kid, I didn't quite lock onto what was happening. So I didn't understand this wasn't the real Sarah Jane. And yet, you know, they get to this point where, like, she goes, like, tipping down a hill. And when she gets to the bottom, her face comes off. And I mean, forget it. I think I had nightmares for weeks. I was like, I was sick. I was homesick, and I was watching from TV. My parents had like rolled the TV into my bedroom, so I could watch Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And I woke up to that, and yeah, it stayed with me to I don't know. Let's see. I was probably five then. I'm 38 now, so 33 years. But I wanted it. You know, I didn't go like, I'll never watch that again. I was like, when's the next episode? And I think that's sort of the, I think that's how kids react, or most kids, I think, react to scary things, is that they are genuinely scared and they kind of like it. They want it. Mm-hmm. It's like a drug. It's kids' first addiction, Alex.
Oh, man. Oh, I got her addicted. Oh, what have I done? If you looked at it, that's probably another one of the major themes of it, right? Because they are being confronted by their fears, and it's treated very differently in the book than it is from the TV movie, than it is from the theatrical movie. But it's always, the constant is about facing your fears and overcoming your fears. And to what you've been talking about, that probably what that feeling is about, that you force yourself to watch. You feel that panic in your heart, but then when you've made it through it, you feel better overall, because you feel braver, you feel stronger. Because even if it's, you know, watching, for me, robot wise, it was the lady turning into the robot at the end of Superman 3 that gave me nightmares.
Forget it.
It's
oh,
the worst.
God.
It's the absolute worst.
I agree completely. Yes. That movie is so bad, but that one scene.
Yeah.
A lifetime of terror.
Right. And you watch those things and they stick with you, but you force yourself to face them. And that's what the kids do at the end of the younger portion of It. And then they face those fears again when they're adults. They come back to them. And if I remember correctly, I mean, I'm curious to see how they do it in the second movie, but it's not quite as strong. The creature has to try different things. It has to try stronger and bigger things when it's coming back again, because it can't affect them the same way as simply as it does as the kid. The fears have to be more complex. And that's how we watch things as well. That's how we watch horror, where, you know, as a kid, you could see somebody's robot face fall off, or you can see Wheelers in Return to Oz and be like, well, that's the scariest thing I've ever seen in my life. But as an adult, you have to watch Hereditary or something that has more emotional depth to it, something that gives you that undercurrent more to think about, because you've already had the jump scares. You've already had, you know, the cat jump out and you scream, and then you're past it. You're expecting it to come. So,
well, I think that makes perfect sense. I think that is absolutely to the core of what makes it such an effective story, both from the childhood angle and from the perspective of being an adult and having to reface some of the same fears, but in a more nuanced way. Yeah, I think about, I saw like Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby when I was younger. And you know what? I got to tell you, when you're young, I mean, I guess there's some parts, like the third act of Exorcist is scary no matter what, but You watch it as an adult, and the first two acts are what's really scary, you know? Mm-hmm. That's the stuff that gets you, and Rosemary's Baby was definitely not a thing that made me scared as a child, but or even as a teenager, but as an adult, the thought of knowing that this child you raise may grow into like a real Satan, and yet you'll still love them anyway, is pretty scary.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty petrifying thought.
It is always really interesting to revisit things. I feel like, you know, we both work in entertainment journalism, so I have barely enough time to check out the entertainment that I do have to, you know, cover on a daily basis. But I always find it very rewarding to do something like that, to watch something. Oh, I watched this as a kid and either I loved this or I hated this, and watching again, not a horror movie, but the first one that comes to mind for me is Casablanca, which I went on after AFI released their top 100 list. I went through and watched as many of those movies as I could, including Casablanca, which I had never seen. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's pretty good. And then years later, a friend invited me to go see it in a movie theater. And I saw it in a crowded movie theater. I didn't realize how funny that movie was. It's very funny. And there were people laughing at it. And I had this dissociative moment while I was watching it where I went, oh, yeah. Oh, they're making jokes in this movie. I didn't realize that the first time through. So those sort of things, whether it is a horror movie or otherwise, it's great to see them at different points in your life. And to your point, yeah, horror in particular, what you are scared of changes over the course of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And also to what you were saying, you get a really different experience of watching something in a theater. And I saw the 2017 It in a theater, and I never, I mean, you know, I don't know. I'm sure somewhere someone has put the 1990 version up on a theater screen, but I imagine that would be very different from, you know, me seeing it on my dinky little old 1990, you know, probably like Hitachi or whatever it was TV that we had at the time, versus seeing something on a big RPX screen mm-hmm. in 2017 around a bunch of other people. And that's another way that's like, that's transformative, is also era, right? Like that's the other thing that I think about, is making it again. This is one of those times where you're adapting something at a different time. And that's the thing that makes adaptation worthwhile, is that, yeah, I mean, like they set this thing in the 80s, and that means that part two is going to be set now. Mm-hmm. And the whole reason this podcast exists, Alex, the reason that it is called Everyday Horror is because every day something new and horrific is happening. And my only coping mechanism is, hey, let's watch a stupid horror movie. And and at the end, people will probably be all right. Or at the very least, we can, you know, contextualize and talk about it and feel safe. That's about the most we can hope for. And so I do think that A, the 2017 movie was great. And B, I don't know if it's actually, it will end up being an important film, but gosh, there's a lot you could do now. A lot that mm-hmm. the titular It can represent in 2019 as the world burns, and it's a lot harder to face just regular day-to-day stuff, and then also have this other thing from your childhood rear its ugly head. It's just another really interesting dimension to what I think could potentially be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, to your point, and to get back to a bunch of the themes that we've been talking about, yeah, it hadn't actually occurred to me that they could take that route, but the idea of things from the past of America, maybe very bad things that seem to be sneaking their way back in again, particularly things that were very prevalent in the 1980s, to your point, coming back in, say, 2019-ish or so, 2018. I don't know if they're going to explicitly do that, because they also weren't very explicit in the first movie.
But the beauty is they don't have to. But they don't have to. That's the mm-hmm. thing that makes it great.
Yeah. So I think that would be great. I mean, if they did that, if they really had that creeping around the edges the same way they had the zonked out, super sweaty parents throughout the 2017 It, I think that would be really interesting. I'm very curious to see if they go that route or some other route, but that would be great. And the one other thing that I wanted to say, just before I forget, this has nothing to do with what we're talking now, but you mentioned the theatrical experience. The one thing, even though I really was legitimately terrified, even sitting in my office watching the 2017 It on a computer with full lights on and plenty of people around me, the one moment that I completely regretted not seeing in a theater, the scene at the end, and I hope everybody has seen the movie, so I'm not totally spoiling it, but the scene at the end where Richie is talking to his friends and he's railing on them. They're in Pennywise's lair and he's like, "You guys, you've cheated me. You've ruined everything. You've made my life terrible. You've dragged me down here." And then he slowly pulls the bat out of the pile and says, "And now I'm going to have to kill this fucking clown." Like, I was terrified watching it in my office. I nearly lost my mind when I heard that. And then when I was thinking about it later, I was so mad that I hadn't forced myself to watch that in a packed theater with people, to watch people just absolutely triumphant. Scream and go nuts when he said that, because the delivery of that line is so good. That's something also that I think you get from horror in a theater that you don't get from watching at home alone, is that sense of catharsis, that sense when, like, I haven't seen the new Halloween, but, you know, that sense of like when a Jamie Lee Curtis takes down Michael Myers at the end of the movie, assuming she does that or doesn't die. Don't ruin it for me.
I'm not going to.
But that sort of thing, that moment at the end when they finally take down the monster, feeling that with everybody else, feeling with that relief, it's so much bigger in a theater versus, say, watching it on a VHS tape at home or just with a couple of people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the same goes for the big scares, because I remember watching the trailers for the 2017 movie and being like, looks all right. Like, I wasn't wowed by those trailers. I was like, looks all right. Looks okay. I was like, I don't know if I'm going to be scared of that. I will tell you, I definitely crawled up my seat a little bit in that theater, which is always the sign that I'm trying to, like, get away from what's on screen. That's when you know you've done it. So I think, yeah, it's got that perfect counterbalance of that stuff, like, especially the projector sequence, because they show the projector sequence in the trailer, but they don't show the part where he comes out gigantic.
Yeah, it's horrifying.
And that absolutely blew my, yeah, I was like, forget this, no thanks. It really freaked me out in the theater. And yeah, the point of pulling out the bat is hugely, hugely cathartic. And and I do think they did a good job of adapting the minefield that is the creepy sexual assault stuff. Not to, yes, you know, I don't, like, I'm not sure that you and I, two male presenting people, are going to have a lot to add to that conversation, but I do think that they did a good job of dealing with that, and certainly it's a lot weirder in the book, and I think that it was better that they suggest what they need to suggest.
Yes,
and again, sort of leave it there.
Stephen King was on a lot of cocaine, so there's that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Although
go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, like, the only thing I've heard people say, and again, this is one of those things where I find myself saying, not for me to make this judgment call, but the racism, they don't, mm-hmm, like, it's clear, but I've heard people say, you know, might as well just have those kids drop an N-bomb. Like, just say it. It's 1980. Mm-hmm. People said it all the time. It's 2018. People say it all the time now. And I am very much on the fence about that, but it was a thing that I found myself thinking about a lot after the film was over, was how you deal with racism in horror specifically.
Yeah, I do think I loved the 2017 It. I thought it was awesomely filmed, very exciting, really terrifying. I think whenever they got too much into a mode, they very quickly veered away from that. There's a point in the movie where it starts to feel episodic, where they're going through everybody's fears. And just to the point where I felt like, this is starting to become a little repetitive, they switched up the rhythm of the movie, and then the same thing kept happening again and again. So it built really nicely. But Mike was definitely pushed to the side. He kind of showed up a little bit and then was there at the end a little bit, but he wasn't as integrated as he could have been in the movie. And a lot of the focus was given to a number of their characters. And, you know, that comes down to you're doing a however long it was, 2.5 hour movie versus a half of a 1100 page book or 1300 page book. So that's going to happen. Yeah. You're going to lose things. But they could have done that part a little better, I think.
I agree. I mean, look, here's my wild guess. I think that it was just, I mean, that's scary. That's like real world scary. Mm. How are we going to write this Mike character? How are we going to deal with the fact that certainly in the book, it's very explicit. The racism is very clear. And I think, yeah, I think they balked at it. I don't like, maybe Chase Palmer, Cary Fukunaga, and Gary Doberman, maybe none of them felt confident in writing that well. I don't know what the reason is, but I could certainly see anybody being a little bit shaky on on feeling like they would be confident to tell that story the correct way. You know who wouldn't be writing that? Me. I would literally just bring somebody else in and I'd be like, hey, I'd certainly like bigotry. Yes, absolutely. That kind of bigotry? Nope. Really don't know the first thing about it. Help me out. So yeah, I mean, like, that's really the only thing I can think of from the film that I found myself looking at and saying, wish they'd had somebody come in and say, hey, make a little more time for Mike and what he's going through there. That's like the only, that's my only complaint about that whole film. Yeah. My one criticism. Otherwise, well, great.
On the other hand, I mean, to get back to, and I realize we shouldn't necessarily talk about this, but on the other hand, I think the teen sexuality part of it, which could have gone ever so horribly wrong, was actually done correctly. Like, they did hit that the right way. The sunbathing scene didn't end up being as creepy as I think any other production would have done it. And just overall, they treated the teens as teens, but not overly sexualized, I guess, is the simple way of putting it. So I do recall coming very specifically out of watching the movie thinking that I was surprised and pleased that they hadn't delved too far into that. So I think there's aspects that they did better than the book, and then there's aspects that they didn't do as strongly as the book.
But overall, yeah, I would say if you were going to point towards really great adaptations from book to film, I feel like this one ranks pretty high.
Yeah, it's kind of shocking, particularly because as a Stephen King fan, when I heard they were only doing the kids, I was furious when I heard that. I was so mad, because how can you do just the kids without the adults? Because that's not just omitting half the book, that's omitting half the themes of the book. Like, the whole idea is that they grow up and that they do have to face this monster again. But the fact that they made it work anyway, made it work as his own movie, and, you know, everybody knew that they were going to bring up the It Chapter 2 title at the end of the movie, but at the same time, holding that until the very end, is, it completely worked. They did a really good job of making it work as a movie, but also not feeling like half an adaptation, which is fantastic.
Boy, they did a killer job. I mean, I think we can pretty much close it out, but James McAvoy and Jessica Chastain and Bill Hader, like, forget it. The people that they're bringing in to do the second half of it are some of the best actors that are working right now. And yeah, we did an episode on Crimson Peak that Jessica Chastain is in. And I mean, is maybe the best thing about that whole movie, and that whole movie is great. So I'm really, I don't know how many people, I mean, I feel like there were a lot of folks that were thinking about her, Bryce Dallas Howard, or I forget who else was on that list for who was going to play adult Beverly Marsh. But man, when I heard it was going to be Jessica Chastain, I thought she's going to be incredible in it. And I think everybody is.
It sounds absolutely fantastic. Absolutely great. I'm really excited for it. The thing that I'm very interested about is, even though it had, what was it, the hugest horror opening of all time, the first It, so clearly there were people that were super into it, there's much more pressure on this second one now to deliver than there was on the first one, which was such an enormous surprise across the board. I mean, you had Finn Wolfhard, who is an enormous star off of Stranger Things. It's a property that people know and loved, but I don't think anybody expected it to be as big or as good as it actually was. So having a ridiculous, absolutely perfect adult cast certainly helps. Having the same people behind the frame really helps as well. But there's certainly, like, I think people are going to go in more with a sense to in chapter two of, all right, prove it. Can you do it again? Which they didn't necessarily go to the first one. So I'm curious to see how that plays out.
Boy, that It movie could have felt strangely redundant after the success of Stranger Things, which was basically the culmination of like every Stephen King thing that ever was. Like it could have, and including Finn Wolfhard, like, you know, yeah, it could have been like, we already got Stranger Things, but instead it was like, no, all right, this is the reason that Stranger Things is good is because of this thing that, that pre-exists it. But yeah. Anyway, hey, let's say, Alex, that somebody listens to this podcast. They've seen It, 2017, 1990, the book, and now they're hungry for more. Mm. They want to, you know, unhinge their jaw and their big old sharp teeth and chomp into some other horror thing that might be similar in some way. What would you recommend to them?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind, it's not exactly similar to It, but if you didn't watch Castle Rock on Hulu, I would highly recommend that. It also stars Bill Skarsgård, who is Pennywise. He plays, for the most part, a creepy character. And the idea of the show, if you didn't know about it, because I think a lot of people kind of skipped it, and frankly, I almost skipped it, even though I love Stephen King, as it takes place in this kind of Stephen King inflected multiverse where they make some references to some things. Sometimes it takes place in the town of Castle Rock. So like somebody talks about that dog attack that happened back in the day, or they pass by, some scenes take place in Shawshank Prison, that sort of thing. So like if you know the novels, it helps, but mostly it's about the themes of Stephen King. But what I'll say about that book, the show is, even as a Stephen King fan, even as somebody who watches TV for a living and wanted to watch it, I wasn't quite into it for the first six episodes or so. And I know people say that about TV shows a lot, but all I'll say is wait for the seventh episode, because when I watch the seventh episode, it completely redefines everything you just watched in the first six episodes and makes it worthwhile. The horror element gets completely amped up. And if you're looking for something that has, without spoiling too much, a connection between what happened with young kids and what happened as adults, they even do the Easter egg down to, what is it, 26 years, 27 years, the life cycle of It? 27 years. So the stuff with the younger characters and the older characters happens 27 years apart and affects each other in terms of the different timelines. So if you just watch It, if you're obsessed with It, if you missed Castle Rock, definitely watch it. I can't recommend it enough, but also I'll definitely recommend stick with it. Stick with it through the seventh episode because you'll understand why once you watch it.
Yeah, it's a good recommendation. Actually, you know, speaking of Stephen King adapted things that basically it feels like nobody was watching that I had to watch for work and then ended up thinking, oh, this is actually pretty good, is Mr. Mercedes, which, I wasn't. It's not bad. I actually was surprised by there are some really solid performances. And I mean, obviously, that's more of a like a crime thing. It's not really horror. I mean, there is horrific stuff in it, but I was surprised by how decent that actually ended up being. And speaking of things that I was surprised by how good they wound up being, I actually think the most obvious thing to watch right now is The Haunting of Hill House.
Oh, right. Oh, that's
the one. That is, I mean, that's again, same thing. Kids dealing with a thing and then having to sort of the way that they deal with it is a little different in the execution, but it is kids dealing with the house, adults dealing with the house. And boy, I really was not sure how to feel about that happening because I knew it was going to be drastically different from the book. And, you know, I mean, Shirley Jackson is like one of the most poetic, beautiful writers of all time. And, you know, it's the same thing as with Castle Rock, which is to say, you got to give it a minute. That first episode, not good. Second episode, it's getting there. And then once you get to episode three, it starts to hit its stride. And Gosh, if you haven't heard, episode 5 is a doozy. It's 10 episodes long. I found it to be extremely gratifying. And I actually, I mean, like, two episodes to and I didn't feel like the first two were complete slogs. The first one, maybe, but even by the end of the second one, you just have to accept that it's a, what's the word I'm looking for? Real sad. That's two words, but it's really sad.
Yeah.
It's super depressing, but it's
very
great.
Well filmed, though. The performances are really good, and it's legitimately scary, which I think is very rare for a TV show. That I'm hard-pressed to think of a TV show that actually has legitimate scares in it, but it's filmed like a horror movie. It plays out like a horror movie. You've probably heard this, but for those who haven't checked out the show or don't know about it, I told my wife about this the other night. She was totally uninterested in Haunting of Hill House, and then I told her this, and she was like, oh, I gotta watch this. There's hidden ghosts in every episode, so don't play into the plot at all, but just kind of
there.
Yeah, they're just kind of hanging out of the background, which is terrifying. That's absolutely a horrifying thing that they did, but it's so cool.
Yeah, no, I really loved it, and highly recommend it to anybody, especially, yeah, if you watched it and you were looking for something that absolutely deals with kids getting scared of something that the primary fear is like kind of jump scary stuff and stuff that's more happening to their parents than just happening to them. And then having to deal with, you know, it again as adults, where it's more about conflict within the family and suicide and drug addiction and really big, heady stuff. And it's executed super well. Anyway, those are good recommendations. We did a great job, you and me, Alex. Pats on the back all around. And now we're going to end the podcast because we did such a good job. But before we go, Alex, where can people find you? Not in your life, because that would be weird, but on the internet.
Two places I can mention. One, decider.com, where I'm managing editor. The other one is I do a weekly live talk show about comic books called Comic Book Club. You can check out information about that at Comic Book Club Live. Or actually three things. I'm usually on Twitter at @azalbin. So check me out there as well.
Perfect. And you can find most of my work at sci-fi.com. This podcast is there. Who Won the Week? My weekly roundup show is there. And then I've got an Amazon podcast that you can find on the sci-fi side of Amazon. And videos and all sorts of stuff. Most of it's at sci-fi.com. And if you're looking for me to run my mouth like an idiot, as I often do, Twitter and Instagram, great places for that. And I'm there at Danny Ordinary. That is Danny with one N, Ordinary, also with one N. Thank you for listening to this podcast. And remember, kids, sometimes the best cure for the horrors of every day is a little everyday horror. We'll see you next time.